You're listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.
So we're in the back of a central security truck after being severely beaten and herded into a sort of holding pen in downtown Cairo. They then transferred us onto the truck and a few more beatings, and we're now being driven out to the desert.
This audio, recorded by Guardian journalist Jack Schenker in Cairo, quickly circulated among the British press and beyond in January, giving remarkable insight into the situation being faced inside the country during what has become known as the Arab Spring. Later in this podcast, which aims to look at the ongoing dangers for journalists across the world, I'll catch up with Jack to find out how the situation in Egypt has changed for journalists post-revolution. Elsewhere in the Arab world, ongoing violence has resulted in reports of killed, injured or detained colleagues on a regular basis. In the past 2 months in Libya alone, the Western media world has lost a number of its reporters, including a British-born journalist and London-based photographer. But of course, much of the danger stems from elsewhere, in those countries which have been at the centre of conflict for years. In March, Reporters Without Borders released its annual death toll, which found Pakistan to be the most dangerous country in the world for the press, with at least 8 journalists killed in connection with their reporting last year. And across the world so far this year, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 19 journalists have been killed. Many of these are local reporters living with threats on their doorstep every day. And with this fear of being attacked, imprisoned or even killed, what exactly can they do to stay safe? For many, it can feel like the only answer is to flee. In fact, just this week, the Committee to Protect Journalists released a report claiming that almost 70 reporters were forced into exile in the past year. Iran and Cuba were found to have banished the highest number of journalists, with 18 forced out of each. And since 2001, at least 649 journalists are understood to have fled following threats of or actual violence, imprisonment and harassment. 91% of them have not yet been able to return home. One such exiled journalist is Youssef Azizi. Youssef was sentenced to 5 years in prison in 2008 in Iran over allegations including acting against national security and propaganda against the regime. In November of 2008, he fled Iran.
When I came to UK, you know, in January 2009, I had a speech in English pen, and after that speech, I told the authorities here that I cannot come back to my country, to Iran, because they may be kill me because I was sentenced to 5 years. And then I criticized the regime in English pen, and then I got my asylum here after, I think, 6 months. But English pen and other cultural and NGOs helped me in this case.
Today, while he feels the situation for journalists in Iran appears to be worsening, he's hopeful that there are steps, however small, being made in reopening media outlets previously prevented from operating.
I heard that gradually want to open some newspapers that have closed, and I heard 2 or 3 reformist dailies, open now, and began to work. I think the regime may be open the atmosphere. Some, not great openness, but some, and we struggling as Iranian journalists in exile to openness, to freedom, and to democracy in Iran. And I think we will reach these aims.
Having heard Yusuf's story, I spoke to Committee to Protect Journalists consultant Elizabeth Witchell to find out more about the main causes for exile and what the report has shown about changes in recent years.
Typically speaking, when we say forced into exile, we mean cases where, that have been subject to so much intimidation or threats of violence or actual violence. Journalists who have been arrested or journalists who have reason to believe that they may be arrested. And those are typically the reasons that people go into exile. Our report found for the last year, the leading cause was fear of arrest or fear of imprisonment. When we look back over the 10-year period, it's the threat of violence. So that is, journalists received death threats, or that their colleagues were killed and they had reason to believe that they might well be next in line. One somewhat unique thing about this last year was in the case of Cuba, because there you had journalists who were, I would say, more literally forced into exile in the sense that they were actually demanded by their own government to leave. And it was these were 18 journalists in prison who had been in prison since 2004 and who were otherwise looking at lengthy sentences, well over 10 years.
While we can clearly see from the outside that the CPJ does a valuable job in keeping track of the worldwide cases of press freedom violations, I wanted to know what it does behind the scenes to try and deal with the situation before things get this far.
When CPJ started 25 years ago, its main mandate was to expose attacks against media in other countries and advocate for change and improvement in press freedom conditions. The sort of work that we're doing in recent years that involves journalists in exile started about 10 years ago when we launched our journalist assistance program and began directly helping journalists under threat relocate, and other ways that we were directly assisting journalists who had been attacked or been threatened. So traditionally, CBJ, I mean, the ideal scenario is, yes, we try to, for example, if we're able to create enough public awareness or enough international pressure around a case, they don't have to go into exile. There's a certain level of protection that comes from international recognition of a case of somebody who's being persecuted for their work.
So, for exiled journalists who do make it to a safe place where they can claim asylum, what will life hold for them then? The experiences of each journalist I spoke to, of course, had their differences, but the overarching message was an undying passion to continue to write. However, as I learnt, their circumstances do not always allow this. I spoke to Abel Ugba, the chairman of the Exiled Journalist Network. He told me that life for many journalists, even once they're granted asylum, can remain very difficult, not just because they're away from home, but because often they are unable to do the one thing they know how, to be a journalist.
It's very frustrating. I don't know how I'm going to put it. It's like you're an artist. That's the only thing you've ever known how to do in your whole life. And suddenly you lost your hands. It can be very frustrating. The people that we deal with, they haven't lost their hands or their limbs or anything, some of them, or the majority of them, but they've been denied that opportunity because of having been transplanted into a different social, political, professional environment, and also because of the psychological trouble of getting embedded in a different environment. They find it difficult to restart their professional practice. And for some of them, it's very frustrating. It can be devastating, actually, because it means for some of them that they never actually return to journalism.
The way to improve the situation for exiled journalists is to give them a platform and a voice, he said. This way they can shed light on the situation they've left behind. But while the network can help them to achieve this, the British mainstream press needs to do more to step up and support the hundreds of exiled journalists in the UK.
We cannot tell the story of those countries better than people from those countries. So we give them the voice, we give them the platform, and we try to give them the outlet by inviting journalists, mainstream journalists from the British media to those events. But so far, We've had some level of success, but not as we would expect from the media here. The more people are aware, the more international pressure is put on those governments, hopefully they will stop persecuting journalists, and then journalists can stay there and work. Many exiled journalists who come in here are not coming in to holiday. They come in because they have to. Many would readily say to you, if they had a conducive environment to practice their trade, they would stay in their country. I would. Who wouldn't? But the sort of condition that pushed them out will not stop unless some of us here are active in helping to prevent it.
So according to Ugba, most exiled journalists do want to one day return home to their countries, but for now most continue to fear the repercussions if they were to do so. So what are the experiences of foreign correspondents and their international news outlets? One news organisation which has been at the centre of reported attacks on the press and its freedoms is Al Jazeera. I asked Al Jazeera English's head of news gathering, Heather Allen, how she felt the dangers facing local journalists differed to that of their correspondents.
I think local journalists are always at more danger than we are, than visiting journalists, and especially non-national journalists of that country. I think, for example, Egyptian journalists or Syrian journalists or Yemen journalists who are nationals of those countries are at far more risk because they live there, their families are there. They have pretty much no diplomatic protection, which quite honestly, when we do go into these countries, unless it's a very isolated, insular country, there's always some sort of diplomatic protection that we can call on. And normally, local journalists do not have that, at least that very thin veneer of protection. The other thing that local journalists don't have, quite honestly, is a ticket out. They usually are holding passports from countries that perhaps it's very hard to get visas into third countries for or second countries for. And so, you know, their ways out are very limited. That's why you usually find in a lot of these countries it's the local journalists who get killed. And who, when you look at the end of the year at how many journalists have been killed around the world, you'll usually find it's local journalists that really cop it the most.
So with the dangers higher for local journalists, what support and protection does Al Jazeera offer to local stringers or reporters that it employs to help with its coverage in dangerous countries?
We weren't in Libya, for example, and we weren't in Tunisia. Our local journalists that we've hired to be fixers and translators and local producers on the ground are all freelancers, but we treat them the same way we treat our staff. Our concern for their safety is such that we, I'll give you an example, in Yemen our freelancer had to sort of go underground for a bit when we got thrown out of Sana'a. We work with them to try and make sure that they're safe. We will take them out the country if we have to, if we can, if it gets to that level. We've had issues in Afghanistan where we've had to bring out our local stringers because there have been threats on their lives. Even if it's just a matter of bringing them into Kabul from the regions, you know, from the provinces. So yes, we do worry about them as much as we worry about any of our staff.
Frequent reports of journalists, both local and foreign, being attacked, detained or even killed can give the perception to some of a growing problem. Obviously, the dangers facing journalists differ from country to country, but I was keen to find out if Heather sees the situation for its correspondents getting worse on a global scale.
I'm not sure that it's any worse. I just think that so many things are happening at the same time that it seems like it might be more. But I think, you know, we, over the years, we've had issues in the DRC when we've gone into the Eastern Congo to follow up on rape allegations and, you know, stories like that. We've always had to have proper safety protocols in place. Where every time we go into Mogadishu, any time we do anything in Somalia, it's, you know, the problems are, could be marauding gangs, it could be, you know, roadblocks where you don't know who's at the roadblock. those are sort of like the physical threats where, you know, you're surrounded, your vehicle is surrounded by armed men. And it can be as subtle as knocks on hotel doors or a hotel receptionist calling up to the room saying, oh, there's people down here asking for Al Jazeera, and we don't know who they are, to people actually being just thumped, just being out of the crowd, somebody just breaks out. And I don't think that's new. I just think that there's so much happening at the moment that we're almost in sort of overload.
Expanding on this point, there's also the greater access to information, which has grown over time, and the ability for journalists and citizens to instantly capture and share audio or video. Together, this helps to bring the audience closer to and make them more aware of the dangers. And so we return to The Guardian's Jack Schenker, whose audio recording from the back of a van in Cairo after he was beaten and forced into the vehicle acts as a hugely powerful example of how close to the story an audience can become.
Come to a stop, and people were banging again and again on the walls to protest, and the truck is now doing quick spurts forward and stopping to throw us all around, and people are saying, now we will definitely get beaten again.
Schenker and the others in the van did manage to escape once the vehicle stopped and the door was unlocked, at which point the group charged out and fled into the desert. Now, months on, I ask him how the situation for journalists like himself has changed since the toppling of President Hosni Mubarak, if at all.
There is a degree of openness now and a degree of access and dialogue, but there's also suspicion. There's quite a conservative and regressive narrative being promulgated by the current ruling elite, which is the armed forces and various kind of Egyptian media commentators that support them, which is about the danger of instability, and that in this kind of post-Mubarak transition period, it's very important for everybody to kind of buckle down and get on with their work and not complain and not highlight the various problems that Egypt is facing at the moment, because, you know, all of that's going to be sorted once we have democratic elections and once, you know, the new Egypt is built. And this narrative is particularly targeted at kind of workers who are currently on strike for better pay and conditions, or for kind of what are dismissively referred to as sectoral interest groups here. i.e., you know, maybe slum dwellers who say, look, our living conditions are unsustainable and dangerous, we need to leave. Any one of a number of kind of there's an explosion of social expectations that have arrived in the aftermath of Mubarak falling, and the prevailing narrative is, no, this is not the time for you to be campaigning for, you know, better rights or whatever. Women as well, you know, when women have been on marches and men demanding you know, better rights for women, you know, again the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has taken the line of, this isn't the time to be dealing with that, kind of stop making trouble, go back home, we'll deal with this all once we have democratic elections. And that narrative affects journalists as well. You know, the idea being that we're troublemakers if we're highlighting some of the problems that Egypt's facing. Criticism of the armed forces is seen as a red line. Certainly Egyptian journalists have fallen foul of that many times, have been hauled in by military prosecutors for daring to question the legitimacy of the military, for criticising the military over things like military tribunals, which are being used to convict, you know, supposed criminals, but without fair trials, the virginity checks that arrested female protesters have had to undergo at the hands of the military. People who have brought this stuff up have been, largely Egyptian journalists, have been hauled in for questioning. So it's not as if, you know, there's been a 180-degree turnaround and suddenly everything is open and, you know, there's complete freedom to discuss everything. So I wouldn't say that, you know, things are completely easy, but there's definitely been an improvement.
You can keep track of the latest news relating to press freedom issues by following journalism.co.uk's Twitter feed @press_freedom. You've been listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.